Hello, everybody. My name is Michael Kahn. I'm a compulsive overeater. And I want to thank Jack for asking me to come out here and to share with you. I appreciate it, Jack. By getting to do this, I get to enjoy the rest of the evening. And I've got a great evening planned. My sister-in-law gave us two tickets to Elaine Stritch at the Amundsen at the Music Center. And I probably wouldn't go, you know, of my own accord, but I read a great article about it, and she talks a little bit about the disease of alcoholism and stuff. And so I'm already looking forward to it. But before I got here, I was ready to fight with my wife. And because I had some expectations, and those expectations were that I was going to be dressed and ready to go, and that she would be dressed and ready to go, and I didn't really communicate that to her. She's not in the program, and I just assumed that, you know, she would. And we dropped our three kids off at the babysitter, and we had lunch before, and by the time we got home, I had a half an hour to get in the shower and to get ready, and she takes longer than a half an hour to get ready, and I should know that after being with her for about 20 years. And so I could just feel, you know, that, you know how the adrenaline gets when you get angry. And if you're like the compulsive overeater of my type, when you feel that adrenaline, you just have to let it out, because it's not right. You'll get ulcers if you don't let it out. You just have to express it. But the problem with that is, in abstinence, when I express it, I say things that I really feel like shit about later on. And then I get that emotional hangover and all that guilt, and I'm in this self-pity, and I mope. And that can last literally for days. And that ain't worth the fix of that short burst of temper that the Big Book says, you know, is the dubious luxury of normal men and women. And so, you know, I've worked this thing for about 12 years imperfectly. And so I, you know, it was all I could do to close my eyes and kiss her goodbye and say, I don't even think I said I loved you, but I kissed her and I said, you know, I'll see you at the theater. And then I called my sponsor and I bitched and moaned to him on the way over here. And, you know, he talked about expectations and communication and, you know, and so just so I could be extra spiritual, you know, talking to you, I called her and I said, you know, I really miss you being here. And so we parted friends, and I'm going to be able, you know, an hour at a time to enjoy the play instead of sitting there all pissed off at her and all that crazy stuff that my head tells me to do. I was a compulsive overeater probably before I started practicing my alcoholism, but I didn't know that before I came to you guys, because I came to you guys through the back door of Alcoholics Anonymous. 1982, I surrendered to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got clean and sober. And at the end of 82, I was smoking three packs of cigarettes a day. And I was getting real uncomfortable with my cigarette addiction. And so I started to complain about that in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. And the old-timers afterwards would come up to me and say, you know, the only requirement for membership here is a desire to stop drinking. Keep your cigarette shit to yourself, huh? And I just felt offended, because up until that time, I thought I could share any... The meetings that I went to in Alcoholics Anonymous, you could share anything. You could throw chairs. There's a format in AA in one of the meetings that says, it don't even matter if you're making sense. You know, you don't even have to understand what you're saying. Just talk. And, ooh, I love those kind of meetings. So I did a lot of talking, except in this particular meeting I went to, I guess I talked to the wrong people, because they tried to censor me, you know, and I was very offended. And somebody came up to me after the meeting and said, put his arm around me and said, you know, Mike, I think there's a Smokers Anonymous. Have you ever tried to go to that? And I think now it's called Nicotine Anonymous. They changed their name. And so, you know, I went. And it was a meeting in Hollywood Boulevard on Yucca Street, and there was one guy, Bora, I'll never forget him. I haven't seen him in a long time. And it was like he was waiting for me. And I sat down, and he proceeded to tell me what he was like, what happened, and what he's like now since the cigarette addiction had been removed. And I didn't even get a chance to bitch or complain. And he said, well, come on back, see you next week. And he shook my hand. And I came back the next week, and, you know, and it was him again, and maybe I got a word or something in edgewise, but lo and behold, I think I showed up 6 weeks in a row, And the obsession was removed. The three-pack-a-day obsession was removed. And I think on the seventh week when I showed up, he elected me secretary of the meeting. And he handed me the big book, and he said, good luck, kid. And then I was secretary, and I'd show up, and many times I was the only person there with a big book. And, you know, a couple of other people would straggle in every once in a while. But I kept smokeless. I was, you know, sober. And as far as the cigarettes were concerned, smober, yes, smober. Oy vey. And then there's another guy that started showing up consistently. And he showed up for a while, and then I nominated him secretary. And then he got to be the secretary of that meeting. And then I went to another meeting and so on. But the thing is during all this time, within 30 days of my sobriety, I had put on 30 pounds. I put on 30 pounds in 30 days. And I got real scared and uncomfortable. And I went to my AA people, and I started complaining about, like, the Haagen-Dazs that I was eating, you know, and the pizzas and the fat burgers and all that good stuff. And I swear, probably the same people that told me to keep my mouth shut. You know, the only requirement for membership. But see, I knew now, because I wasn't as offended, because I knew that there was Overeaters Anonymous. So I came to you guys, and I kind of sat in the back, and I listened to how you guys work this thing. And I heard a lot of people didn't eat sugar, and a lot of people ate three meals a day, and they didn't eat anything in between, and some people didn't eat starch and white flour and stuff like that. And I had it. And so I went back to my AA meetings. I don't know about you, but after you get home from a good meeting, you know, you get hungry, you know? And I still was hungry, and I wasn't abstaining. I wasn't abstaining. I didn't know that I wasn't abstaining because I didn't know what I was really putting in my mouth except, you know, like a gallon or half gallon of Haagen-Dazs. I remember one night during the Academy Awards, I ordered from some pizza that gives you that thick pizza, a medium pizza, and I ate the whole pizza during the pre-show, you know. And then when I woke up, the Academy Awards were over. And I thought, shit, I mean, this was before I had a VCR, and I missed the whole Academy Awards. And so, anyway, after about a year of messing around with this program, and I came to you guys, and I raised my hand, and I said, my name is Michael, I'm a compulsive overeater, and I need help. And that was the key, you know, to admit, to have the humility that I didn't know how to do this thing. And there's a guy, Matt M., I'll never forget him. He was lost over 100 pounds, and he reached his hand out to me. He says, call me. And I called him the next morning, and he was just very loving and very kind, and he asked me what I was going to eat that day for food. And I said, well, I don't know. And he said, why don't you figure it out? Or why don't you eat what you're going to eat, and then write it down, and then tell me what you ate the next morning? And I did that. And I don't remember specifically what it was, but I know I was surprised because it was the first time that I took a fifth step, like with my food. I admitted to God, to myself, and another human being the exact nature of my food. And I started to get some awareness of what I was putting in my body. And I was embarrassed, and I didn't want to be honest a lot of times. And Matt was loving enough to let me know that it was okay. And he started me out with what I've been doing for all these years, a day at a time. I'd say 99.9% of the time, I take a fifth step with my food on a daily basis, and it's normally to my sponsor. I admit to you, to myself, and another human being the exact nature of my food, and that helps me take a first step to get on the right track on a daily basis. And even when I mess up with my food, you know, I get right back on if I have that honesty to admit. And the consistency of calling my sponsor is good also, because I don't trust very many people. So getting in the habit of calling my sponsor consistently has held me in good stead. So I was cruising along with you guys, and the 30 pounds like dropped off like that, and I didn't have any problem with that. But after about 5 years of being comfortable in this program and my other program, there was a girl who was a newcomer in this program, and she started talking about being abused as a child and having a horrible childhood, and she was going to this group therapy, this ACA type thing. And I'll tell you, my background, I come from a mother who suffered from something called postpartum depression. And that's fairly common, I think, with women who have children. But hers never went away. It developed into postpartum psychosis, and it, you know, as long as I can remember, she was diagnosed as being a schizophrenic, a full-blown schizophrenic. And what had happened to her is she became very suicidal when we tried to keep her at home, and she spent most of her life in Patton State Hospital out in San Bernardino. And she was so sick that she would beg for shock treatments. I guess for her, shock treatments was like maybe a couple of pizzas to us. It shocked her. For me, I feel anesthetized when I do that, but shock treatment shocked her back into reality for a temporary time, and she was able to deal with life on life's terms in a supervised, you know, environment for a few days until she went back into that crazy place where she came from. And in the early 50s, they had this operation called a lobotomy, and they thought that if they cut a certain portion of your brain that, you know, that was disease, that you would be okay. And my mother begged to have that done. She was just in a lot of discomfort. And she had it done, and she didn't get any better, but she didn't get any worse. And so my thoughts of her were going to Patton State with my dad when I was a kid. And sometimes she'd be lucid and she'd say, "Michael, I want to take care of you guys. I'm going to come home." And other times she'd be like catatonic and she'd lash out at my father and be real angry and stuff. So those were my memories of my mom. And I'll tell you, when this lady talked about, you know, being abused as a kid, I know that when I took my inventory at first, I thought I was abused by my grandmother because my grandmother had raised me. And she was very, very pissed off. She had a husband that pulled geographics all over the place. He was an alcoholic. He was not self-supporting through his own contributions. My grandmother had three children, one of which was my father. Now, my father married this schizophrenic lady and thought that he could save her, despite what the doctors told him. Said that, you know, he was going to love her back to health. You know, I don't know if he knew about Al-Anon in those days, but he could have been a nice candidate for that. So he started to drive himself a little crazy, and he had ulcers, and he had colitis, and he had liver disease, and he drank on top of all of this. So he was in and out of hospitals and physically ill. So my grandmother was really going crazy with, you know, having a husband that was an alcoholic and a son that, you know, drank a lot and was in and out of hospitals. Her other son, at the age of 30, decided to come out of the closet and tell the family that he was gay. Now, in the early 60s, it was not fashionable to come out of the closet and do this. So I can remember my Uncle Danny, God rest his soul, taking me into a room and just weeping. And I must have been about 11 years old at the time. And saying, you know, I'm living with a guy. I like guys. Nobody in the family understands, Michael. I just feel so sad. And my 11-year-old solution at the time was saying, well, Uncle Danny, I feel bad, but, you know, it's real easy. Just like women. Why don't you just like women? And he said, oh, Michael, I wish it was that easy. And he just cried. And a couple weeks later, he killed himself. He died of, he overdosed on Red Devils. So my grandmother had to live with that on her conscience. So here's this lady that's in her 60s and decides to take on the responsibility of raising me. And she's pissed off. And she's an Al-Anon without a program. And she's just crazy. And when I don't pick up my clothes, she, goddamn, hazer shadam kid, why don't you pick up your clothes? You're driving me crazy. And I just, you know, she just screamed and yelled at me. And, you know, if I ate, she wanted me to eat three meals a day. She didn't want me to eat junk food. She wanted me to turn off the TV after a certain time. She wanted everything that my sponsor, now in OA, wants me to do. But she was mad. She was pissed off about it. And I was mad because I knew I was a good kid. And, you know, and I'd fight her back tooth and nail. And she'd always win. And she'd hold grudges, you know. And I'd hate her because she'd hold grudges against me. And I held grudges against her. And so I needed to express my anger, I thought, at 5 years of abstinence. And, yeah, I was abused. My mother left me, and I got into this group therapy situation. And I was in it for 4.5 years. And every time I would, you know, bring my teddy bear to group therapy and stuff and talk about how my mother was a bitch for abusing me and my grandmother was a bitch, and I expressed all my feelings and everything, and then I go to my OA meeting and they tell me, well, Michael, if you feel mad or you feel bad, reach out to a newcomer, reach out to somebody else so that you can feel better. And I reach out, and then I go to my therapy, and I go, these guys are nuts. How can I reach out? I feel lousy. I need to feel my feelings. And for me, I couldn't synthesize therapy and the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know how to reach out to others and to forgive and to forget and to do all that stuff and to feel my feelings at the same time. So I was nuts. So I had a choice to pull back from therapy or pull back from OA. And I chose to pull back from OA. And I ended up having three therapists, and I ended up having the shrink. I was at a job for 12 and a half years on a part-time basis because in those days I was an actor. And one of the other 12 steps, because I really diversified in the 12-step programs, even though I pulled away from you guys, I got involved in ACA, I think, in Al-Anon, in Arts Anonymous, which was Artists Recovery in the 12 steps. And in Arts Anonymous, I didn't know what to identify. I couldn't be a compulsive overeater, couldn't be an alcoholic. Was I an actor? Was I a writer? Was I a singer? Was I a dancer? I wanted to be all of those things. So I finally came up with, my name is Michael, and I am a channel for God's infinite creative process. And that covered everything, you know. And so when I would call my sponsor, and when I was in this job for 12 and a half years, and, oh, and by the way, these people in the job would say, Mike, why don't you commit to working full-time here? You're almost full-time. You know, you're a pretty good worker. And I'd say, I can't. I need to have the flexibility to go on auditions. So I'd get off at 12 or 1 o'clock, and I don't know if there were any auditions available, but I had to get a tan before I'd go on auditions. So, you know, we live close to the beach. We're in Southern California. So I'd go to the beach, and I'd run a little bit, and I'd get a tan and everything. And I must have went on maybe two, three auditions total in the 12 and a half years I was working. But I was ready. I mean, you know, I had the tan and everything. And so I'd call my sponsor, and I'd say, you know, I'm filing. I'm 12 and a half years in this job. I'm stuck. What do I do? And he says, Mike, quit. But before you quit, get a backup job. Get yourself another job. And I say, okay, I won't quit today. And I'd hang up the phone. Now, I was too scared to get a backup job to do the footwork on that. And so one day, when I was with these three therapists and I had pulled away from you guys, I called my sponsor and he was not at his desk. So I called somebody in Arts Anonymous. And I said, you know what? They got me filing. I feel like shit. What am I going to do? And he says, Michael, go with what's in your heart. And what was in my heart was to give my 2 weeks notice. And I gave my 2 weeks notice, and sure enough, 2 weeks later, I was gone from that job. And I was having a good time because I was seeing my three therapists, and I was going to these other extraneous 12-step meetings and everything. But I had about 3 months worth of bank account. And after the bank account dissipated, was gone, I didn't have a job. So the rent was due, and the bills were due, and the lady I was living with was also working full-time but did not have enough money, thank God, to support both of us through her own contributions. And I didn't know what to do, and I got real scared. And that's about the time that the psychiatrist prescribed Prozac for me so that I could, I guess I could mellow out, I guess, that I was going up and down and round and round. And I remember calling the psychiatrist and saying, this Prozac isn't working. And he says, well, what do you mean? And I said, well, I don't feel anything. And he said, well, you're not supposed to feel anything. It's supposed to level you out. And I said, well, I don't want to be leveled out. I want to feel some relief. I want to feel, I wanted to use that medication alcoholically is what I was doing. And so he prescribed some more for me, and I still didn't feel anything, except maybe if I wouldn't get out of work, I wouldn't feel as guilty, you know. So I developed a prayer during this time. I get on my knees, and I say, God, if it be thy will for me to have a job or to find a job, let me go out and do it. And then I get back in bed, and I wake up about noon. And I'd say, oh, well, God, I guess it's not your will for me today. And the lady I was living with was really getting pissed. The landlord was really getting pissed. And I started to sweat a lot. And I had, you know, at this time, I had about 7 years of abstinence and sobriety, clean and sober. So I had like a belly full and a head full of program, but I wasn't working the program. I was practicing the ism of the disease. And I always had wanted to hear Dr. Paul speak. Dr. Paul is in our big book. They changed the name of the story from Dr. Alcoholic Addict to, I think, On Acceptance in the new big book. It's like my favorite story. And when I heard that he was alive, I always wanted to hear him speak because his story resonated with me. And so in this building downstairs, he was speaking. And I came and I heard him. And he spoke about this new medication that was out at the time that people, he read in the Wall Street Journal, were killing themselves, were committing suicide behind this. And he says, I can't remember this medication. And everybody yelled out, it's Prozac! And he says, yeah, that's the name of it. He says, how many people are on that medication? And not a one person raised their hand in the room. But most importantly, I didn't raise my hand, and I knew I was on it. What was I hiding? And then he said a second thing that I'll never forget that really resonated for me. And at the time, he had like 20-some-odd years of sobriety. And he said, never in my 20-some-odd years of sobriety have I had a problem to which the 12-step have not given me a solution. And that felt so good to me because I was so confused and I was so far away from the 12 steps and sponsorship and home groups and consistency and commitments at meetings and all the stuff that I kind of half-assed did when I was around you the first time. And I was too afraid to get his number, but his wife Max was sitting in the front row and I got his number and I called him up to make a long story short, he brought me back to the 12 steps and to the program. And what had happened was after about being with him for a month and calling him consistently and starting to work the steps again, I had heard people in my other group talking about how they conned their doctors into prescribing medication for them and so on and so forth. And I told Paul that I was thinking of joining a home group. I had never had a home group in AA or OA. And I told him the specific group that I was going to join, and he said, I think that's a good idea. So I got myself a sponsor in this home group, and I just was feeling uneasy inside. I went to a convention in San Diego, and I talked to this lady, and I'm mentioning my sobriety. I know this is an OA meeting, but for me, my sobriety and my abstinence go hand in hand. And if I'm drinking and I'm using, I'm not abstinent. That's me, because I'm an alcoholic. So if I'm drinking and I'm calling myself abstinent, they go hand in hand. I went to this lady, and I said, I'm thinking of changing my sobriety date. I wasn't even thinking about my abstinence at the time. And she said, you know what, Michael? She says, I can't tell you what to do. She said, if you want to stay sober, and in this meeting I'm going to say abstinent as well, because for me it's the same thing, a day at a time, for the rest of your life, you have to make a decision between you and your higher power that you're going to feel comfortable with a day at a time for the rest of your life. And I thought about that for a while, and I knew that the medication that I was using it alcoholically. And I had stopped. I had given up the medication. I wasn't on it for a few months at that time. And I went to my sponsor at the time, and I went to Paul, and I said, you know, I'm thinking of changing my sobriety date. And he said, okay. I said, that's your decision. That's fine. I went to my hard AA sponsor, and he said, okay, I think that's a good idea. So I switched. I changed my sobriety. I had 7 years clean and sober at the time, and I gave it up. I was a newcomer all over again. And then I started thinking, no, I didn't think too much. I came back to AA with a fervor that I had in the beginning, and I started doing what my home group did in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I started gaining weight again, and I was staying away from you guys. And I went to my AA sponsor, and I said, you know what? I said, I'm gaining a lot of weight. I used to go to OA, and he said, kid, he said, try every diet you can possibly try, and if it doesn't work, you can go back to Overeaters Anonymous. I didn't want to, you know, this same sponsor, and those of you who are in both programs, you know, God bless alcoholics, it's my primary program, but, you know, this guy was, I was in his office years ago, and he offered me a piece of candy, and I said, is it sugarless? And his reply, you're going to die on Skid Row drunk, and you're worried about sugar, for Christ's sake? And I thought, oh, Jesus, I'll take the candy, please, you know. So, you know, a couple of years later, he offered me candy, and I thought, okay, I know what I'll say now. I'll say, thank you, and I'll take the candy, and I'll came back to you guys. And it was kind of easy for me because, like, I know I've come to the conclusion that if I'm drinking and using, I ain't abstinent, you know. And if I'm eating my Haagen-Dazs and if I'm eating like a pig and binging, I mean, that's going to lead to my losing my sobriety. I believe that. I know I lost my sobriety, and I started eating like a pig. So they go one and one. So July 20th, 1990 is my abstinence date, and it goes hand in hand with my sobriety date. And it makes, and I'm so glad that it's so simple for me right now. I got me a part-time job, and I didn't want to commit to working full-time. I married the lady that I was living with. She got pregnant, not necessarily in that order. She got pregnant, and we were just talking about Isabella. She's our first kid. She's 10 years old now. And what had happened was I was working this two part-time jobs and trying to juggle these bills and everything. And there's a guy in the program that takes some people into his house and who are irresponsible with money. And he helps me meet on a weekly, every other week basis. And my wife, Christine, is not in the program. But he demands that if you're going to discuss money issues and you're married, you have to come to this particular thing together. So Christine surrendered with me, and for about 3.5 years, we started getting our financial life in order again. And it wasn't easy, and we fought a lot about finances. And we made a commitment not to fight, and we would just turn our will and our life over to the care of this finance sponsor that we had every other week. And it really worked, and my life started to come together. And I remember making two mistakes. The first mistake was going to my sponsor and saying, you know, I was still an actor at the time. I said, you know, about 17 years ago, I was going to Cal State LA, and I was in the middle of student teaching, and I just gave it up. I actually gave it up to practice my disease. And he says, well, why don't you go back and see what it would take to get your teaching credential? And I said, well, I don't want to get my teaching credential. I don't think I want to teach. I think I want to act, I think. And he said, you know what, Michael? He said, it doesn't matter whether you want to teach, whether you want to act, whatever you want to do. What the principle here is to go back and complete something that you left unfinished. Can you go back and at least talk to a counselor? So that resonated with me, and I went back and I talked to a counselor. And lo and behold, you know, a year later, I got my own class, my own classroom, and I'm teaching kindergarten through second grade kids that are physically health impaired, orthopedically handicapped, little six-year-olds with kidney transplants and a muscular dystrophy and heart pacemakers. I mean, my heart literally melted and goes out to these kids. And I call my sponsor periodically. I call him on a daily basis, but I call him in a lot of fear, and I go, what am I going to do for these kids? I mean, I don't think I'm teaching them. He says, just shut up, Michael, and love the kids. My sponsor was Richie at the time. I don't know if you guys remember Richie. Richie went and deserted me a couple years ago for a wife, and he moved to New York back east. But I had Richie on this program for 10 years, and he was just a godsend for me. So I got this teaching commitment, and this finance guy would say, you know, I'd say to him, and I didn't get any sympathy like I did in therapy from people who were really working this program. I'd say, you know what, Vince, you know, I'm 43 years old, and I've never had a full-time job. And you know, I'd expect him to say, well, no wonder you're scared. You know, just take little bit of bait. You know what that son of a bitch said? He says, you're 43 years old. Well, you better get your ass out there and get moving quickly, you dummy. You know, at least that's what it sounded like to me, you know. And he kicked my butt, and he called me on my stuff. If they don't find out who I really am in July, I will have been working at this job for 8 years. Same job, same school, consistency. That's a miracle. That's a miracle for somebody who was too afraid to get out of bed to go look for even a part-time job. So we had Isabella, and Ileana came along 7 years ago. And then about 3-4 years ago, maybe five,
Christine had gotten pregnant again, and we weren't expecting this one, and we got really scared. And, you know, it was all we could do for two, you know, and we're going to have a third. What are we going to do now? What do you do in this program if you don't eat? What do? You accept what is, you know, and you try to live with what's going on. And so we went from fear and anger to acceptance, and we started to get excited about it. And then 1 weekend, Christine miscarried. And I remember going to St. John's Hospital, and she had the DNC, which is real traumatic experience, more so, I'm sure, for her than for me. But at St. John's, they ask if you want clergy to come in before the procedure. And, you know, Chris says no. And I said, yes. I said, you know, I'm Jewish. And if you send in a nun or something, they just want you to know that I'm Jewish, like if that matters, you know. I got all these old kind of ideas also from growing up Jewish. And so this plainclothes nun came in, and we held hands, and I told her I was Jewish, you know, just in case she was going to zap me or anything like that. And we held hands, and she said something to the effect, you know, please, God, this is a very serious emotional time for this couple, and please let them be closer together and make them bond them and to find strength in this. We don't always know your ways, but for some reason you chose to take this life, and just glad, God bless both of these people. And, you know, I was crying, and she was crying, and we, you know, I never felt closer to Christine. And I went to my sponsor, and I told him what had happened, and I said, you know what? I said, we were so excited about having this kid, and we went to the obstetrician, and he says, you know, if you're going to have another one, you got to do it now because you're both getting older. I says, well, we were thinking of maybe, you know, going for it again. And he said, you know, why don't you look at it this way, Mike? It's nice if it happens, and it's nice if it doesn't happen. So it happened. So Nicholas was born on January 5th, 1999. And so we have three kids. We're done. I can prove that medically, that we're finished. You know, my life is incredibly good. And I've got all this responsibility that in the disease I never wanted. I've got this structure in my life that I never thought I wanted. My dictator sponsors, you know, suggested that if I go to meetings, I get a commitment at the meetings. Otherwise, I don't show up. And I knew this to be a fact from my last abstinence, because if there was an OA meeting that I would normally show up to and there was a Laker game on, of course the Laker game was, I'll go next week. But for some reason, the magic of having a commitment, especially in the group that I'm in, you know, you don't show up, you got shit to pay afterwards. And it holds me in good stead. It really does, and I show up no matter what. What else have I learned? I don't know. You know, in this teaching job, you know, I told you that I didn't like to go to work very much. We're in a year-round school, and we teach 4 months, and we're off 2 months. And we teach 4 months, and we're off 2 months. And we get paid for the whole year. So I get a paycheck on a monthly basis, whether I teach or not. So I've been off for 6 weeks. And I take my kids and my wife to school and wake up at my first sponsee calls at 10 minutes to 6 in the morning. And I try to get them out by 6:30, a quarter to 7, take them to work, take them to school. We're a one-car family. Christine has a bus pass. So when she has the car and the kids, I take the bus and the subway, which is actually fun if you've never driven the subway. Chris has taken the subway, by the way, to the music center tonight, which is kind of scary to think that she's dressed up, but she has a higher power, too. And my commitment is to be here tonight. Yesterday, I have a 26-year-old son. Here's a good story. From a previous marriage, I wonder why I was married and it didn't last before when I was practicing the disease. Sean is 26 years old. When he was five, I was still practicing the disease and doing a lot of binging and a lot of drugs and a lot of alcohol. My wife and I were both, and she had gotten pregnant, and I was scared to death. My father had just died from cirrhosis of the liver. My father and I were very close. When he was out of the hospital, they finally gave him an ileostomy, which is when they take your intestine and they put a hole here and you defecate from a bag. He was in terrible physical shape, but that ileostomy saved his life. And he managed to put some consistent time out of the hospital. And we moved out together when I was 16, and we became roommates. And we lived in a wonderful Hazerstall together and practiced, you know, our disease and just lived the life of Riley. And he ended up dying of cirrhosis of the liver when I was 29 years old. And I had this five-year-old son, and I had this wife that I was married to and didn't have a clue of how to communicate with. And she was pregnant again. And my solution was, you know, Helen, we got to tell the doctor how much drugs and alcohol we're doing. We got to tell him. It's not fair to the kid. In retrospect, I could care less about the kid. I didn't want another kid. I was scared to death. So his suggestion was to abort the child. My wife was Orthodox Jewish at the time, and, you know, they don't do stuff like that. But we did it. We did it. So there was a life that was taken. And I'm not proud of that, but it just, you know, we do not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. I haven't had to do that to my three kids that have come out, thank God, healthy. Like I say, I teach kids with physical health impairments, and every day they remind me of the blessings of having healthy children as well. Those kids with physical health impairments are blessings to me. They've got an attitude and a sensitivity towards each other that has to be a gift from God. They teach me every day. Yesterday I went with Sean, my 26-year-old, and Nikki, who was my 4-year-old. He thought he had a free pass to Universal Studios. So we hop in the car, we go down there, and sure enough, one of the free passes says it expires on March the 26th. So the old Michael, well, let's see if we can get in anyway. But I had heard that they don't expire, you know. I took it to the window and I said, can we get a pass for today? They gave us a pass for today. We're all three going in, and somebody stops Nikki and says, how old is he? Sean says, he's 4. Sir, if you're 3 to 9, you've got to pay the full child's price of $40 to get in there. We were only going to spend a couple of hours. So my 26-year-old says, well, let's try the other window, Dad. We can get him in. And I said, wait a minute. I've done stuff like that in abstinence, and I've had to go back and pay the money and apologize. So I've done it enough to know that. So, you know what? You guys go. And for a couple of hours, we have our cell phone. I'm going to go see Anger Management with Jack Nicholson and Adam Sandler, which is a great movie, by the way. It's stupid, but it's good. If you cop resentments as easy as I do, it's a good release. And I went to see the movie, and Nikki and I came out, and Sean took us back to the sitter, and I picked up my girls. And I took them to their after-school program. I tell you, I worked this program in all my affairs on a daily basis. That 10-year-old wanted to sleep over her friend's house last night. Now, I don't know whether I'm overprotective or underprotective or what's going on, so I run it by my sponsor. I call my sponsor and I say, she wants to sleep at this girl's house. This girl got the movie The Ring for her birthday, and she's watching movies like The Ring. Am I going to let my little girl stay over somebody who watches The Ring? And I thought for sure my sponsor said, she's 10, keep her. You know what, 10-year-old girls, is the mother's going to supervise. Let her go, Mike. Let her go. And hearing that from my sponsor, I was able to let her go. And so she spent the night over her girlfriend's house. And gave me a little time alone with my wife, because our other two kids fall asleep before we do. Issa doesn't usually. She stays up. And so we had some time. Is it time? Oh, good. I have 4 minutes on my watch, but I'll stop. Must be getting boring, huh? Anyway, I was impressing myself. All right. I've been trained to follow directions, so I appreciate it. And besides, I'll probably learn something from listening to your questions as well. Thank you for letting me share. Repeat the question in the microphone. Somebody lay one on me, please. Yes.
You mentioned when you were in therapy, you were dealing with a lot of your feelings, anger, and you might a lot of it was justified with your childhood. And then it's programmed. My question is, how do you work the 12 steps dealing with anger and sort of mourning your past?
I think that that I gave a lot of my anger up when I took a fifth step this time around. I retook the steps. And when my anger comes up, which is now inappropriate, because I've already dealt with it in the fifth step and cleared it away in the past, my sponsor sort of takes me up by the heels and says, you know, time to move on, Michael. It's, you know, that was then and this is now. You're not a kid anymore. It happened a long time ago. Most of my family is dead from the disease. So where my anger comes up is the relationships that remind me of the past. And then my sponsor always sort of, you know, tips me up back the head and gets me back on track. And, you know, I got to do a lot of praying because I'm afraid. I'm afraid of people that remind me of my grandmother, who was this big looming person that screamed and yelled at me, and I felt guilty as hell. And so I'll cower, and so I ask God, like in the fourth step prayer, it says in the big book, to remove my fear. Perhaps this person is sick as well, or maturing as well. I know my grandmother was. She had a lot of problems. I wouldn't want to have to live without a 12-step program and go through what she went through. God save me from being angry. How can I be of service to this person? I may not be of service, but, you know, it can tell me how to be patient and tolerant attitude, at least towards everybody. And if I don't want to hang out with somebody, I don't have to, you know. It's the best as I can answer that. Jack. Well, my relationship with God and how I maintain it, it's not always perfect. On a perfect day, normally when I go to work, I really have a good relationship with God because I wake up in the morning and I'm scared. And I have sponsees that call me that get me in touch with God. I have 5 or 6 meditation books that I have by the computer. And anything that rings true for me out of that meditation book, when I read it, I'll type it up real quick. And out of those 5 or 6 books, I'll usually have a nice little chunk of spiritual stuff. I'll fold it up and I'll put it in my back pocket, and I'll take it out periodically and I'll look at it, and that gives me comfort. I talk to my sponsor in the morning. I take a little AEIOU inventory that keeps me in touch with my feelings, what's going on. I pray I get on my knees in the morning. I say, thank you, God, for another day of abstinence, and please grant me another 24 hours. And when I go to bed, I say that, and I thank my higher power as well. I was reading Chuck C's book recently in the back, and he said, boy, if I had to pray to get my attitude straight, you know, I'd be in trouble. He said, I have to live this program a day, you know, on a constant basis. So I'm constantly talking to God. And he said, I always say to myself, God is my refuge and my strength. God is my refuge and my strength. So those little things, you know, stick in my mind. And so that's the last sneeze on the truth. God is my refuge and strength. Sneeze again. Okay. So that's a little snippet. Yes. It's a little quick inventory that tells what was my abstinence. I tell my, what is the AEIOU inventory? Tell what I've eaten. Did I get any exercise? What did I do for myself yesterday? I guess it was taking myself to the movie. What did I do for others? Because I can tend to forget about doing for others really quickly. Any feelings that have come up that I've uncovered, you know, any secrets that I'm keeping, AEIOU, and then there's a Y at the end of it, which is a Yahoo, something that was outstanding that happened during the day. Forces me to look for good things, and 3 G's, 3 gratefuls, 3 gratitudes. Just real quick, spot check, 5-10 minutes at the most, because I can get just as self-obsessed with my writing, you know, as I can with my disease. So it's just a real quick spot check inventory. The first day of my abstinence was of taking a fifth step with my food. No matter what I ate, I admitted the exact nature of my food. Okay? And then I think my sponsor had me write down what foods made me uncomfortable after I ate them and what foods didn't. And my abstinence has evolved now to I eat three meals a day. Nothing in between. If I eat an hour after I eat, that I consider that another meal. Okay? If I want to have popcorn at the movies, which I do occasionally, I call it in before I have it. Okay? I didn't eat popcorn yesterday. That's amazing. What else? Oh, and one of my meals, because some people are so fanatic here, they don't even eat starch for the whole day. I haven't gotten to that point. I'm 12 years abstinent. But what I was willing to do, my sponsor asked if I was willing to commit one meal without starch. And that's relatively easy for me, a day at a time. I have one meal without starch, without bread, pasta, rice, corn, whatever it is. The other day I had two meals without starch. I wasn't even trying, you know. So it's sort of an evolving thing with me. And I know in my head that fruits and vegetables are healthy, you know. And I know that Richie used to say red meat is an artery clogger. Clogs your arteries. I know chicken is better for me. So I think we know. We know intrinsically what's good for us. But working with a sponsor, you know, on a consistent basis and just being honest, good, bad, or indifferent, the exact nature of my food was the start for me. And I believe that my experience is that it evolves and it comes and you get comfortable. Okay. Yes.
Since you're here, Mike, how do you deal with living with a normie? I don't know if where you were in your absence when you met your wife and how she responded to your sobriety and your abstinence, and how do you deal with your children if you seem sort of like tendencies towards that kind of personality?
I really have to surrender that. Nine times out of ten when something's going on with me, I'm going to project it on Christine or my kids, and I'm going to react to it. So it's really important for me to do that AEIOU on a consistent basis and to leave them alone. And God, I don't want to go to Al-Anon. I just don't want to go to Al-Anon. But, you know, they say in Al-Anon that they have a higher power, too. And if I just concentrate on the things that I can change, which is my actions, my attitude, and amazingly, they get better. I don't know why or how, you know. I mean, Christine was real loving tonight. I mean, I could have been a real asshole and blown up the whole meeting. Why can't she come to OA? It's part of my life. So maybe she is a compulsive. She eats chips between meals. She eats like a pig sometimes. And I get pissed off about it. I gotta keep that to myself, okay? That's it. Thank you.